This is Word for Word, Public Radio's national speech series from American Public Media. I'm Melinda Penkava. At one point during his recent trip to the Mideast, President Bush said the U.S. is on track to bring 20,000 troops home from Iraq. But after meeting with Army General David Petraeus, the president also said it is up to Petraeus to decide if the scheduled troop drawdown from Iraq should be slowed down to ensure success and stability there. General Petraeus is expected to report to Congress in March about the situation on the ground, and he's expected to make recommendations for the future of U.S. military involvement in Iraq. Whether, when, and at what rate to pull out of that country is arguably one of the most difficult challenges facing the United States. It comes at a time when many Americans may be suffering from Iraq fatigue, and that, Gerard Powers says, could lead to moral myopia. Gerard Powers is director of policy studies at the Joan B. Kroc Institute for International Peace Studies at the University of Notre Dame, and he coordinates the Catholic Peacebuilding Network. In a recent speech, he said that the U.S. and Americans in general should take a step back from the debate about troop withdrawal and first consider more carefully what ethical responsibility the U.S. has in Iraq. It's Powers' speech we'll hear this hour on Word for Word. Gerard Powers has led the Peace Studies Institute at Notre Dame since 2004. Before that, he was director of the Office of International Justice and Peace of the U.S. Conference of Catholic Bishops. He's also served as a foreign policy advisor with the Bishops Group, specializing in European affairs, religious liberty, and the ethics of the use of force. As you'll hear, Gerard Powers referred to his work with the Conference of Bishops as he opened his speech at the City Club of Cleveland earlier this month. Here, then, Gerard Powers speaking about the ethics of exit.
In 2003, I thought I had a tough task to explain why the Catholic Church found the war to be morally problematic, when most Americans, including the leadership of both political parties, supported it, and when the war seemed to be going quite well at the time. My task today is in many ways more difficult. It would be easy and much more in keeping with my personal predilections to make the case that since it was immoral to intervene in the first place, the argument I made 5 years ago, it must be immoral to stay. But that conclusion would vastly oversimplify what is at stake morally. This is probably the toughest issue of ethics and foreign policy our country has faced in at least a generation. Continued U.S. engagement is clearly fueling the violence. Yet lacking viable alternatives, continued U.S. engagement appears necessary to avoid even more killing and chaos. There is no military solution to the multiple conflicts in Iraq, yet political and economic progress is not likely without substantial improvement in the security situation. We must grieve deeply every American life that has been lost in this war. But how do you weigh morally the fact that we have now? That in the last 6 months, the surge has led to an increase in U.S. military deaths, in part responsible because of the surge, but a decrease in Iraqi civilian deaths because of the change in U.S. policy. I want to address five moral arguments that are commonly used to resolve the conundrums we face in Iraq and explain why each needs to be modified by what I will call an ethic of responsibility toward the Iraqi people. I've already mentioned the first. Since it was immoral to intervene, surely it must be immoral to stay. In my talk here at the beginning of the war, I cited some of the reasons the U.S. Catholic bishops, for whom I then worked, found the Iraq intervention to be morally problematic. Two are especially important. First, the preventive war arguments that were being used and are still being used by the Bush administration to justify the war constituted a sharp and dangerous departure from traditional legal and moral norms. These norms limit the use of force to defense against ongoing aggression or against an imminent attack. But they prohibit preventive wars which are designed to defend against potential or gathering dangers, as the president has said many times. The second moral concern that the bishops had was that a preventive war aimed at toppling a repressive and aggressive Iraqi regime would become a war of occupation, which could lead to unintended and uncontrollable consequences for the United States, for Iraq, for the Middle East, and for our efforts to combat terrorism globally. Recently, in a letter to the U.S. Catholic bishops, Representative Marcy Kaptur of Ohio and a number of other Catholic Democrats cited these and other concerns in arguing that the immorality of the original intervention makes it immoral to stay. Many anti-war activists make the same argument. Clearly, the ethics of intervention and the ethics of exit are related. Efforts to gain Iraqi international support for U.S.-led rebuilding have certainly been complicated by the fact that many consider the original intervention to have been illegitimate. It's hard to rebuild a country when your presence there is not considered credible and legitimate. That said, the ethics of intervention and the ethics of exit are mostly distinct issues. A just war can lead to an unjust peace, and an unjust war can lead to a just peace. The moral challenge we face now in Iraq is to ensure that an unjust war does not lead to an unjust peace. Those of us who were against the war in 2003 must acknowledge that once the United States toppled the Iraqi regime, the moral issues changed. Let me explain by addressing the inadequacies of a second often used moral argument. According to this argument, U.S. needs and interests should be paramount in any moral analysis of what to do about Iraq. Many opponents of the war rally their anti-war supporters by glibly equating the withdrawal of U.S. troops with ending the war in Iraq. And both opponents and supporters of current U.S. policy often define the issue the way Republican Senator John Warner defined it in questioning General David Petraeus. What policies and strategies will best serve U.S. national security interest? Both approaches imply, explicitly or implicitly, that what ought to be done in Iraq should be defined mainly in terms of what is best for our troops and our interest. Now, it's neither surprising nor inappropriate that we focus on what's good for Americans. It would be morally irresponsible if we did not give significant weight to our moral obligations to the small percentage of American men and women who are shouldering the burden of building peace in Iraq, almost 4,000 of whom have died doing so. It would be morally irresponsible if we did not take into account the moral costs of spending some $2 billion per week in Iraq when so many other pressing needs at home and abroad go unmet. And it would be morally irresponsible if we did not consider whether remaining mired in Iraq served legitimate U.S. interest. But it's easy to have moral clarity about what we owe ourselves. What is often missing in the debate is serious consideration of what we owe Iraqis. Many people have noted that Colin Powell's aphorism, "We broke it, we bought it." It has a lot of moral merit, but it needs to be modified slightly. It should be, "We broke it, we have to try to fix it." Noah Feldman, a constitutional advisor to the Coalition Provisional Authority, wrote an excellent book entitled What We Owe Iraq. He rightly maintains that when the U.S. overthrew the Iraqi government and became the de jure, or legal occupying power, it willingly incurred a host of legal and moral responsibilities to promote the common good of the Iraqi people until a legitimate and effective Iraqi government could take over those responsibilities. As a temporary substitute political authority, what the U.S. owed Iraqis is akin to what the United States owes its own citizens. Now, legally, the United States is no longer occupying Iraq. But what we broke is still mostly broken. By almost any measure, Iraq is a failed state. So morally, the U.S. retains significant residual responsibilities to the Iraqi people. A third problematic moral argument. Many recognize that the U.S. has obligations to Iraqis, but they define these obligations in a minimalist way. The list of obligations typically includes protecting against al-Qaeda-related terrorists in Iraq, training and equipping Iraqi security forces, providing reconstruction assistance, pressing Iraqis to meet benchmarks for political reconciliation, like sharing of oil resources, agreeing on a constitutional provisions, new elections at the province, at the provincial level, etc. Deterring Iran and other Iraqi neighbors from intervening and taking in more Iraqi refugees, especially those who have been supporting U.S. efforts in Iraq. All the Democratic presidential candidates argue for a version of this minimalist understanding of U.S. obligations. Now, these are legitimate goals, but they're too limited. Are they commensurate with the obligations incurred when the U.S. occupied Iraq? Despite the obvious difficulties, the originally stated U.S. objectives of building an Iraq that is peaceful, united, stable, democratic, and secure are closer to what the United States owes Iraqis than the minimalist alternatives. The problem with U.S. policy is that it has willed the right ends, but not the means to achieve them. The stated objectives have not been minimalist, but too often the means have been. The disconnect between maximalist ends and minimalist means has been especially egregious with respect to protecting Iraqi civilians from violence. The first obligation of an occupying power is to ensure basic security for the population. Yet the United States has not had the number and kinds of troops, or until recently, the appropriate tactics and strategies necessary to meet that obligation to secure law and order in Iraq. Until the current surge of U.S. troops made this an integral part of their mission, protecting Iraqi civilians was not a priority for the United States. The Democratic presidential candidates agree that it shouldn't be, even though it is clear that Iraqi security forces cannot do it on their own and are often implicated in the violence against civilians. The failure to acknowledge our obligation to provide basic security until the Iraqi government can do it on its own has alienated Iraqis, forced them to seek protection from sectarian militias or through sectarian militias, and provided fertile ground in which insurgents and terrorists can operate. I would state U.S. responsibilities to Iraqis more robustly than the Democratic presidential candidates do, and more robustly than what the Bush administration has done in practice, at least until recently. The obligation is not to end all political violence, but to help the Iraqi government maintain a reasonable degree of security for the whole country so that the threat of chaos or civil war is remote. Not to impose a Western-style democracy, the United States has long abandoned that goal, but to facilitate establishment of a stable, legitimate government that respects human rights, especially minority rights. Not to hold out for a U.S.-style capitalist economy, but to do much more to restore Iraq's infrastructure in a viable economy that serves Iraqi needs, not U.S. interest, especially not U.S. oil interest. Not to impose its will on the Iraqi people, but to stay only with the consent of the Iraqi government and preferably the United Nations. A fourth tendency in trying to resolve the moral conundrums in Iraq is to increasingly place the burden of moral responsibility for the state of affairs in Iraq on Iraqis. How can the U.S. continue to be held responsible, many ask, when Iraqis remain mired in sectarian conflicts born of ancient hatreds? To be sure, Iraq is riven by deep divisions, which ultimately must be resolved by Iraqis, not the United States or any other outside intervener. But the United States is hardly a disinterested humanitarian offering what Fuad Ajami has called the foreigner's gift of political freedom. The United States did Iraq a huge favor by ousting one of the world's worst dictators, but we should not forget how deeply implicated the United States is in the turmoil in Iraq. The United States supported Iraq in its war against Iran during Saddam Hussein's genocide against the Kurds, devastated Iraq during the 1991 war and the ensuing decade-long embargo, overthrew its government in 2003, and then displayed gross negligence and incompetence in dealing with the aftermath. The U.S. role in Iraq might not be ancient, but it is very much part of any hatreds there. The United States can no more walk away with a clear conscience than a father can abandon the mother of his illegitimate child.
Gerard Powers speaking earlier this month at the City Club of Cleveland. He directs policy studies at the Joan B. Kroc Institute for International Peace Studies at the University of Notre Dame. And he coordinates the Catholic Peacebuilding Network. This is Word for Word from American Public Media. Now back to Gerard Powers and his speech about the ethics of exit from Iraq.
Like it or not, the responsibilities of the United States and Iraq are inextricably intertwined. It is right for the U.S. government to insist that the Iraqi government account for its own failures and meet legitimate benchmarks for progress in state building. But the United States will have little credibility holding Iraqis accountable if it does not account for its own role over many years in creating or at least exacerbating problems in Iraq and find ways to address the consequences. The fifth argument is the hardest to refute. That is that the statute of limitations has run on our obligations to Iraqis. After $415 billion, and that's a conservative estimate, 4,000 dead and thousands wounded, it seems reasonable to conclude that the United States has done all that it can do. A continued U.S. military presence is counterproductive, and therefore it's time to turn things over to the Iraqis. This is the conclusion of H.R. 3087, which passed the House in October. The resolution was clear, quote, "The government of Iraq must now be responsible for Iraq's future course," unquote. Reflecting the views of many of his colleagues, Carl Levin, the chairman of the Senate Armed Services Committee, explained that the way to get the Iraqi leaders to assume their responsibilities is to set early deadlines for withdrawal of U.S. troops so Iraqis would be forced to look into the abyss of a civil war or a nation. Now, ethicists like to say ought implies can. If the United States does not have a reasonable chance to succeed in Iraq, or the U.S. presence is doing more harm than good, surely the United States doesn't have a moral duty to keep trying. We only need look at the 16 times from Cuba in 1898 to Afghanistan in 2001 that the United States used military force to promote nation building. According to a count by analysts at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace, 11 military interventions failed to establish a functioning democracy. 4 succeeded, West Germany, Japan, Grenada, and Panama, and Afghanistan remains in doubt. Yes, ought implies can, and the good should outweigh the bad. But we can assess the can or calculate the proportion of good versus bad consequences if we aren't clear about the ought. The fact that Iraq is a failed state that has descended into chaos is not an argument, in my view, for withdrawal, but is evidence that the United States has to find more effective ways to work with Iraqis, other governments in the region, and the international community to fill the political and security void created by its 2003 invasion. I fear the calls for firm deadlines for withdrawal or redeployment of U.S. forces are less the product of a sober assessment of what it takes to succeed in the daunting nation-building project the United States has willingly, though wrongly, undertaken, and more a reflection of the fact that patience and sacrifice are virtues not always evident in U.S. foreign policy. The United States has been rightly criticized for its lack of sustained and effective follow-through after its interventions in Central America, Haiti, Afghanistan in the late 1970s, and Somalia. Even if there had been a realistic post-war plan and all had gone according to that plan in Iraq, would it have been reasonable to expect a stable, united Iraq with an agreed constitution and a respected and effective government that could survive on its own? Would it have been reasonable to expect all of that in only 4 or 5 years? Would proponents of Senator Levin's high-stakes game of chicken be so confident of its efficacy or be so willing to impose the burden of moral risk on a long victimized Iraqi people if their calculations began with a more robust understanding of what the United States owes Iraqis? Moreover, if the risk of uncontrollable, unintended consequences was a reason for opposing the original intervention, the risk of uncontrollable, unintended consequences is a reason for opposing a too rapid withdrawal. If the United States was not already in Iraq, It is quite conceivable that there would be forums like this around the country calling for humanitarian intervention to end the suffering. When 75,000 civilians, a conservative estimate, have been killed, when 3.6 million people have fled their homes, and when 60% of the population is without clean water. We can't criticize the United States and the international community for not intervening to stop the sectarian strife in Darfur while insisting that disengagement is the appropriate response to sectarian strife in Iraq, sectarian strife which, unlike Darfur, is a direct result of U.S. actions. Most of us suffer from Iraq fatigue. Whether we supported the war or opposed it, we want out of Iraq. So it's not surprising that we place our hopes in speculation that things couldn't get worse and insist that strict deadlines would make it better. But those hopes might be tragically misplaced, and our deadlines might backfire. The situation in Iraq is bad, no doubt, but it could get much, much worse. It's not crying wolf to predict genocide and serious regional instability if the United States withdraws prematurely. We should be wary of imposing that risk on Iraq and its neighbors based on a calculus which minimizes U.S. responsibility and underestimates the magnitude of the Iraqi people's current and potential suffering. Reliance on best-case scenarios got us into the current predicament. It's not a strategy for getting us out. In 2003, millions took to the streets around the world to protest the invasion of Iraq, protests that Pope John Paul II called a sign of the awakened conscience of humanity. The fact that we see relatively few mass protests today is a sign, among other things, that 4.5 years later, most people recognize that there are no morally clear or clean answers to the conundrums we face in Iraq. To suggest otherwise would be intellectually dishonest. This truth is easy to lose sight of amidst the polarized partisan debate, which is only intensifying in this election year. The five arguments I've highlighted: if war is immoral, it must be immoral to stay. U.S. needs and interests are paramount. U.S. obligations to Iraqis should be minimal. Iraqis are mostly responsible for their own fate, and we have done all that we can do. These five arguments, each in their own way, I think reflect a moral myopia, which can easily obscure our vision of what should be done now. We need to refocus the moral debate about Iraq on an ethic of responsibility. An ethic of responsibility would not resolve the many tough policy decisions that must be made. That's not the role of ethics. But it can help frame the debate and keep us from forgetting what we owe to whom. The Iraq intervention may have been an optional, immoral war, but continued U.S. engagement is not an optional moral commitment. The United States has multiple, often conflicting obligations to protect its troops and to promote the common good of our nation, but also to protect Iraqis and to promote the common good of theirs. Debates about how and when to withdraw from Iraq will continue to be confused if we are not more clear about what we owe Iraqis, how we have failed them to date, and how we can do better to meet our obligations to them. We should stop equating the withdrawal of U.S. troops with an end to the war and be more clear about our duty to do what we can to end the war that we helped unleash between Sunnis and Shiites, to end the Sunni insurgency, to end the terrorist attacks on Iraqi civilians, and to end the general chaos in Iraq. But wouldn't this ethic of responsibility and its robust obligations to help with nation building Iraq easily become a new form of the white man's burden? Isn't it a short step from an ethic of responsibility to an ethic of neocolonialism and imperial hubris? While U.S. policies, including U.S. policies in Iraq, have sometimes reflected such tendencies, I don't think that an ethic of neocolonialism is deeply ingrained in the American character or psyche. We are much more prone to neo-isolationism than neocolonialism. I believe an ethic of responsibility can help counter the vision of U.S. hegemony that undergirds the Bush administration's preventive war doctrine. If exiting Iraq is based on the assumption that protecting U.S. interest trumps U.S. moral responsibilities to Iraqis, what basis is there for arguing that U.S. national security interest and a desire to maintain U.S. dominance should not trump moral norms against the kind of preventive war that got us into Iraq in the first place. In the context of the war on terrorism, such preventive wars will remain all too tempting and all too easy for the world's hyperpower if it is not required to bear the burden of what it has wrought. To date, we have mostly failed Iraq, but I maintain hope that past failure need not beget future failure. Many say it is too late and too costly to fix what we have broken. Whether we have reached a point of futility in Iraq or should still try to salvage what moral integrity is still possible isn't clear to me. If we reach the point where we simply cannot do what we ought to do, we should withdraw. But we should do so not with self-righteous calls to end an immoral war, but with a deep sense of anguish, remorse, and foreboding at the consequences of our failure to live up to our obligations to the Iraqi people, and with a renewed commitment to reject in the future morally bankrupt doctrines of preventive war, which got us into this war of occupation in the first place. Thank you.
Gerard Powers is the Director of Policy Studies at the Joan B. Kroc Institute for International Peace Studies at the University of Notre Dame. He spoke earlier in January at the City Club of Cleveland, and you're hearing him on Word for Word from American Public Media. I'm Melinda Penkava. After his speech, Gerard Powers took questions from the audience.
My question is going to be a little difficult because I basically disagreed with many of the fundamental assumptions that you based your talk on, and I was very disappointed. However, here we are in January, the month that we honor Dr. Martin Luther King's birthday, and this is going to be the 40th anniversary of his assassination. I want to know why you exclude the opportunity for us to address the withdrawal with verifiable, effective techniques of nonviolence and an international force. Why does the U.S. have to be there holding guns and building permanent military bases?
The U.S. shouldn't be building permanent military bases. One way that the United States could be clear that it has Iraqi interest in mind and not its own interest is to commit to not building permanent military bases in Iraq. And your question on nonviolence, I work at a peace institute, and what we do is we study nonviolent ways to resolve conflicts. So I agree very much with the direction that you would like to go. We saw effective nonviolence in Iraq in the beginning of the post-war situation, 2003 and part of 2004. Ayatollah Sistani, who is the most important Iraqi Shiite leader in Iraq, did an amazing job of keeping the Shiites from responding with force to constant provocations by the Sunni insurgents and al-Qaeda in Iraq. It was amazing what he was able to do. But then there was the bombing in 2004 of one of the Shiites' most famous shrines. And the Mahdi militia finally said, enough's enough. And they had already been using force, but Sistani was still holding sway over the general Shiite population. And then you get into this back and forth sectarian violence. And one of the problems was that because the United States at that time did not see it as a priority to provide security to the Iraqi population, they did not do what they should have been doing to protect against that outbreak of sectarian violence. They should have been protecting the mosques on both sides. They should have been trying to protect the populations. But we were concerned about getting embroiled in this internecine conflict. But we were there. We were embroiled in it. I don't think you can say that we don't do sectarian conflict. We entered Iraq, which we knew was rife with sectarian divisions. You can't wash your hands and say, sorry, we're in charge of law and order as an occupying power, but we don't do sectarian conflict, which we knew was there in the first place. Now, so what about nonviolence? It was tried in Iraq and was successful to an important extent for a while. there's a lot that the United States military can do and is beginning to do more of that is nonviolent. It's working with local populations. They're setting up local political, helping to set up local political authorities. We have regular conversations with the military officers at Notre Dame, almost all of whom have been in Iraq, and they're doing all kinds of jobs, nonviolent work, to try to rebuild Iraq that are not in their job description and that they're not prepared to do. Part of the problem with the United States preparation was we didn't prepare, we didn't send in the right kind of people and the right kind of forces to do the kind of local policing, the kind of local political and economic development work that you need to do. That's the kind of force you need. You need some sort of a UN reconstruction force that can go in, and the UN would be better than the United States. It's kind of like your idea, that can go in with people who specialize in rebuilding countries torn by war, in helping in state building, in all different ways. You need to do more to the UN and other international actors to develop that kind of nonviolent action to deal with the massive questions that you got to deal with in these kinds of post-conflict situations.
I want to thank you so much for your comments. I came in very narrow in my thinking. Let's get out of there. No more of our kids killed. No more of everything that's going on. What you did for me was expand my horizon of thinking, and I couldn't disagree with anything you said. But I'm one citizen with one vote who, on the policy level, the decision-making level, could help us explore the issues that you raised and do something about changing our policy.
Are you referring to presidential candidates in particular?
No, just because I'm wearing the Hillary button means nothing.
I didn't make this up out of whole cloth. There are a lot of people in the public debate on Iraq, and a lot of people are raising these kinds of questions. I'm not always entirely comfortable with some of my allies in this, because they tend to be the people who are on the other side when we were debating whether or not to go into Iraq in the first place. But there are a variety of people. I think General Zinni is one person who has a lot of thoughtful things to say about Iraq. I mentioned Noah Feldman. I think he's an academic but was involved in the Coalition Provisional Authority. I think you should read his book. It's an excellent little book. So I think there are a lot of people out there, but I'm not the only one who's raising some of these concerns.
Could you expand today's discussion to include your similar type of approach to Afghanistan and Pakistan? And secondly, is there a way that we can build industries and an economy in these three countries so that they can continue as a viable entity?
Well, Afghanistan, I'm not a specialist in either Afghanistan or Pakistan, but one of the mistakes that the United States made, and many people pointed this out before we went into Iraq, was Iraq diverted our attention from Afghanistan and Pakistan in a lot of ways. In Pakistan was the same, similar problem. We went in to topple a government. I think that intervention could be defended. That was more of a classic case of responding to aggression, which was by Al Qaeda, which was basically a wholly owned subsidiary of, the Taliban, which is basically a wholly owned subsidiary of Al Qaeda. But the United States then kind of dropped the ball in Iraq in many ways. One example is they brought in international forces but only limited their operation to the capital, the area around the capital. We didn't provide the reconstruction assistance immediately. The massive Marshall Plan that was promised was not forthcoming immediately in Afghanistan. So we made some of the same mistakes. We had the robust maximalist goals, but then we pursued it with minimalist means in some respects. And Iraq was one of the reasons for that, because we We simply put our energies into Iraq. We saw that as the next front on the war on terrorism, which it has become. But we've been ignoring Afghanistan. Pakistan is a very tough question. I think we are faced with the same dilemmas there that we were faced with in Iraq in the 1980s, and we're faced with throughout the Middle East. Is, do you support the people in power, the dictators in power who are friendly, who seem friendly to your interests, or do you take the risk of promoting some form of democratization? I would think we should be a little more risk-taking in trying to promote some democratization, because if the Democrats who are getting killed in Iraq are not the alternative, Al-Qaeda or some sort of radical Islamic regime is probably more likely the alternative.
Mr. Powers, I thank you too for stimulating me to revisit a concept that had become background, and that is the notion of preventive or preemptive war. Because when you help me sort of think quietly and carefully about that, I realize that part of its tremendous peril as a national strategy is that the war aim of the war is stated in the negative. You're trying to make something not happen. And I would welcome your comments in a very general way as to whether or not, if you look at history fairly broadly, you see this as a very dangerous concept for deploying the powers of war when the aims in a preventive war or a preemptive war are not clear, positive, and attainable, but they are literally to try to make something not happen.
I'm very concerned about preventive war. That's why I'm trying to make the argument that you gotta hold the United States' feet to the fire for the consequences of pursuing a preventive war if you're going to prevent future preventive wars. And it's amazing to me that we're still talking about preventive war, that we haven't abandoned this concept given how wrong it's what it's led to in Iraq. There are lots of problems with preventive war. I mentioned the main one is that it blows apart our contemporary understanding of when force is legitimate and when it's not. You know, to say that force is possible and morally permissible or legally permissible whenever there is a gathering danger means that there are no limits on the use of force. What if every country adopted this doctrine? You know, what if India and Pakistan adopted this doctrine? What if Russia and Ukraine adopted this doctrine? What Iran and Israel, if they adopted a doctrine of preventive war, it seems like Israel might well be adopting a doctrine of preventive war. Hopefully they will not implement that against Iran. But you can see how the instability that it would create in the international arena if we went down this road. And basically, preventive war assumes that it doesn't. It's not a rule that applies to everybody. It's just an option for the most powerful countries because it would be so destabilizing. So it creates, it's based on a sense of U.S. exceptionalism, that the rules that we follow are not rules that the rest of the world should follow. It's also extremely speculative, your point. It creates scenarios, the mushroom cloud in New York, which we heard so much about in 2002 and early 2003, it creates these speculative scenarios about what the threat is or might become that lead you to make false choices. You know, the mushroom cloud or let Saddam Hussein stay in power. It's a false choice. And it's based on speculation, which in this case proved to be entirely unfounded. The weapons of mass destruction weren't there. So preventive war is a terrible idea that has to be rejected, precisely for those and for other reasons. But the other reason it has to be rejected is because preventive wars tend to become wars of occupation, as I said. And wars of occupation create all the problems that we're seeing in Iraq today.
You're listening to Gerard Powers of the University of Notre Dame taking questions after a speech he gave this month at the City Club of Cleveland. This is word for word from American Public Media.
If the candidate-elect would ask you to be his or her advisor on Iraq, Afghanistan, what would you advise them to say in their inaugural address in the State of the Union to the country and to the world?
The probability that I will be asked to advise one of them is quite slim. I would advise that the president-elect be more clear about the mistakes that the United States has already been made and about our responsibility to try to rectify that. Ultimately, you need some sort of process of reconciliation in Iraq. There's a lot of talk about how the Iraqis have to reconcile, but the United States has to be part of that reconciliation process because we are inextricably intertwined in what's going on in Iraq. And we've done a lot of things that have not been helpful to Iraq over the years. I try to refocus away from deadlines for withdrawal and try to focus more on the kind of political issues that have to be resolved and try to get the debate beyond, you know, should we withdraw and when, which is too much of the focus right now, is on the particulars of U.S. military engagement. We ought to step back and look at some of the bigger questions.
It may be an oversimplification, but we seem to recognize that there are three distinct areas in Iraq, Kurdish areas, the Sunni area, and the Shiite. Shiites being totally backed by Iran. In any general election, I think it's conceded with 60% of the population, Iraq would be Shiite and a subsidiary of Iran, I believe. Can we turn back the clock? Iraq was created in 1920, I believe, conglomeration of various countries, pieces chopped out, a country called Transjordan, if I'm correct. Can we turn it back to and defend the three distinct areas that seem to want to bind together but separately?
The situation of we face a problem of self-determination in Iraq, which is not unlike the problem of self-determination we face in other former colonial entities that are really not natural states, if you define a natural state historically or by common history, culture, language, etc. The Brits, like they did in many other parts of the world and like other colonial powers did, drew a map, and it didn't necessarily correspond to what the people on the ground wanted. So the problem is not unique to Iraq, the problem of self-determination. This situation is like Bosnia, except it's much, much more serious in terms of that question. What do you do when you have three parties who don't seem to want to live together? Although, for what they're worth, and they're not very reliable, public opinion polls in Iraq tend to show that a large majority of Iraqis do want to stay as a united country, probably because they recognize what the chaos that might ensue if it moves toward breaking up. I don't think it's necessarily the case that a Shiite-dominated Iraq will simply be at the beck and call of Iran. I don't know the history, but there's a history there, I understand it, that there is an Iraqi Shiite identity that is different, defines itself differently from the Iranian identity. Ayatollah Sistani, even though he was trained in Iran, is not simply pursuing Iranian government or religious policies, as I understand it. That is a fear. I think that's more likely to happen if you break up the country. If the country is broken up, then the Shiites will more likely feel reliant on Iran. The Sunnis will rely on Saudi Arabia and some of the other Sunni neighbors, and the Kurds will be left out there on their own. And that's why I think that many people who are calling for withdrawal say, well, we'll withdraw, but we're going to stay and protect the Kurds because they don't have any natural protectors in the region. I think Senator Biden's idea that you have some sort of a soft partition, you know, a strong central government in some areas, but significant regional autonomy for the three main groups, makes some sense, but there's always the risk that partition is a synonym for ethnic cleansing. And there's been too much ethnic cleansing already in Iraq. So it's a very delicate balance. I don't have an easy answer. You'd like to say self-determination, let the Kurds have their own country, let the Shiites and the Sunnis have their own, but it's a very, very complicated and messy thing, and it could lead to a very serious problem within Iraq and also within the region.
Mr. Powers, I'm very thoughtful in listening to your remarks. The fact that we have a power struggle going on in Iraq between the various interpretations of religion, and the fact that we've had tribal warfare all over the world, we're experiencing again in several countries, how do we solve this problem, and why do we have to be responsible for a civil war that's going on in Iraq? This is a division amongst people who are struggling for power and basing it on religious interpretation. But it's very common in this world. I just finished reading Karen Armstrong's Muhammad. Let me tell you, tribal warfare was evident all over the world.
That's the reason why many people argue that we not get in the first place, but we're in. And so I don't know how we can just, as I said, we can just say, this is tribal warfare, that's not in our job description. You know, there are all kinds of causes of war. War is never easy it's never easy to reconcile if people are fighting each other. I am not entirely convinced that because there's some religious dimension to it, that it necessarily makes things any worse than if they're fighting over oil, for example. And I think in Iraq, there are many different things that they're fighting over. It's about religious identity. It's about ethnic identity. It's about oil. It's about who controls the country. It's about a lot of things. It's not just about sectarianism. So there's no easy answer. But we're there. We're part of the sectarian. We've made ourselves over the years part of the sectarian divisions in Iraq. And we can't pretend that that's not the case. And we have to do what we can. Wars do end. Tribal wars do end. Sectarian wars do end. And the challenge, of course, is to figure out how best, what role the United States can do in helping to end this tribal war in which it willingly became engaged.
Mr. Power, Iraq is due to their history, is a violent society. How can nonviolent do a thing until they work out their own strategy? They want to become a country within themselves, but as of now, the only way that Iraq became stable is with one strong individual for one of the tribes, which was the Sunnis. But there's so much animosity left by our involvement that if we leave the Shiite, unless we divide the country, we'll eliminate any opposition from the Surds and the Kurds. And we'll have the same thing we had before, one strong man running the country. And this peaceful solution to it is difficult to apply in a violent society through their history.
Yeah. Well, even in societies that have been riven by sectarian warfare, there are people who use their religious identity, use their tribal identity to, in the best of the values that are represented in those identities, to promote peace and to pursue nonviolence. It would really be, I think, insulting to Iraqis to suggest that your ordinary Iraqi Sunni or Shiite naturally hate each other. They don't want to work together. They can't work together. They've been working together in different ways for many, many centuries. There are some violent elements within their communities that they have to deal with. So we can't assume that because it's sectarian, the religious and tribal and ethnic and nationalist identities that are behind that sectarianism always lead toward violence. Because there's a lot of good in those identities. There's a lot of people who want a peaceful Iraq. We have to assume that, and people I've talked to, soldiers I've talked to, you know, say that over and over again. That you know, the ordinary Iraqis they run into want an end to this. They don't want to be part of this sectarian violence. So the second part of your question, I think I didn't.
The second part of my question, in regard to the society themselves, it has been throughout history, Iraq, the only way they've had any stability is one individual.
You're going to end up with
for one group, ran the country as a whole, which was Saddam Hussein at this time. If we keep it up, and you so-called, at the beginning, unless they go through a whole history of nonviolence, the nonviolent themselves are going to be eliminated because they're going to be treated just like they treat the United States now, as a joke.
Yeah, that's a real risk, is that the solution is to put a new Saddam Hussein in power, and everyone will be forced to get along because of a repressive government. I don't think that's the only alternative. It's quite possible that you can find a political accommodation where there's some sort of relative balance between the three major groups in Iraq, and that's what they're trying to do through the constitutional reforms that still need to be carried out. But we should be careful to look at false choices. It's either Saddam Hussein or sectarian violence. I think there are a lot of options in between that could be pursued.
Gerard Powers, speaking January 4th at the City Club of Cleveland. Powers is the director of policy studies at the Joan B. Kroc Institute for International Peace Studies at the University of Notre Dame. He also coordinates the Catholic Peacebuilding Network. If you missed part of this hour's speech by Gerard Powers, or if you would just like to hear it again, you may do so by visiting our website. It's wordforword.org. In addition to hearing this week's show, you may subscribe to our free weekly podcast and listen to any of our previous programs, including speeches by former Secretary of State Colin Powell, Iraq scholar Ellen Lapson, and Senator Jim Webb of Virginia. Thanks for joining us for this edition of Word for Word for American Public Media. I'm Melinda Pencava.
Word for Word is produced by Larissa Anderson with associate producer Patty Ray Rudolph, and the technical director is Sam Keenan.
American Public Media.